Heather was doing this two truths and a lie, and I thought, well, that'd be kind of fun for me too. So if you want to play, now you're not going to get any secret answers. I'm curious how well you will do. I'm curious how Josh will do, but let's see how this goes. So here we go. Here are two truths and a lie. I can pick my nose with my tongue. It's two truths and a lie, not two yummies and a gross. Yeah. All right. So I can pick my nose with my tongue. In high school, I was the first chair trumpet player in the honor band, so I was fourth best in all of Northern California in high school. And I have been able to juggle since eighth grade. Only two. There's two truths and a lie. So which one do we think it is? Wait! Don't speak out loud here, Mister. Okay. Well, let's see your answers. The nose. Yeah. Anyone there? Okay. What about number two? Is fourth best? Oh, Josh has a fourth best trumpet player in all of Northern California. And then what was number three? I've been able to juggle since eighth grade. You guys all seem very uncertain. It's great. They're all lies? No. So it's interesting. I was worried because Joshua, you know, he's part of our family. But I think Anthony, as he was listening, picked up on something. Which one is the lie? Number two. I didn't play the trumpet. I played the trombone. So I was, but it's again, like Heather, it was mostly true. I was the fourth best trombone player in high school in all of Northern California, being in that honor chair. But yeah, I played the trombone, not the trumpet. Yes, I can pick my nose with my tongue. No, I won't perform it, though I would be really fun to get like an Uber close-up. I think that would be really fun. And yes, I actually do know how to juggle. I was taught, what was that? You've never seen me juggle? Is that why you chose number three? Are there three more spherically shaped objects? Yeah, because I can do it with other stuff, but it gets a little bit more dicey. Can I, you borrow your AirPods here for a second? All right. No, okay. Is there other objects? If I had chainsaws, I was thinking about doing that. What was that? Oh, the shake, but I think there's only one shaker up here. Yeah. Anyway, I can juggle, so if you want to see either the juggling or my nose picking with my tongue after church, just come and see me and we'll be good. We are going to be talking about lying today, but we're going to take it in a little bit different fashion. We're going to take it in a way the text asks us to take it. Obviously, we know that lying is wrong and we shouldn't be doing that. I think pretty much everyone agrees, and we can start splitting hairs of, you know, when to lie or are certain lies okay or not. But I think a more difficult question is, what do we do when we are lied to? What if we are the one who enters into a contract with someone, or we entered some sort of agreement with someone, and we come to find out that that person lied before the arrangement and ends up changing things? I know health insurance companies do this all the time, right? You mark on there that you're not a smoker, but then, you know, once every 3 years, you might have a cigarette, and the insurance company scours through your social media, finds that you've smoked once, and says, you lied, and because you lied, your policy is now null and void. Or you're interviewing for a job application, right? You're interviewing for a job, and it says, are you proficient in Microsoft Tools? You don't even know what Microsoft Tools is. You've heard of Microsoft Word, but Excel and Access, those are all, I have no idea what those are. But you really, really, really badly need the job. So you say, yeah, I can do that, hoping that maybe you'll get some training on the fly, and then they come to find out that you have no idea what you're doing, and they say, well, you lied, and so that's breach of contract, and so we're going to end it. I think most of us are okay on things like that, But I'm going to go one deeper. What do you do when you don't enter into a contract, but you enter into a covenant with someone else? Now, the hard part is we don't have many covenants left this day. The closest one that we have is marriage, a covenant. You know, we made vows one and to another before God and before witnesses. But I came up with two examples. I don't know. What would you think in this? How would you advise? So imagine you're a pastor of a church and you're entertaining going to another congregation, and that congregation is going to issue what's called a divine call. There's a very covenantal relationship there, and they say to you, hey, we're going to provide for you a parsonage, this amount in salary, and then we're also going to pay for your doctorate. And, you know, but come and covenant to be our pastor, and we'll covenant to be your congregation. And then imagine that the pastor arrives, that there really is no parsonage. It's really more of kind of a closet with a bed in it. And they actually don't have the funds to pay your salary or your doctorate. Should the pastor continue on in the covenant? Or imagine a young lady ends up going too far with her boyfriends in high school. But then later on, as she's come to faith, she realizes what she's been doing is wrong, and so she starts doing things much better. And then she meets a guy, and the guy says, you know, my goal has always been to marry someone who has not been with anyone else. And so the guy, obviously early on as the dating is going on, asks the female, have you been with anyone else? And she's scared. She realizes this is the best relationship she's had in a really long time, and she's really ashamed of her past things, and she's even asked for forgiveness. So isn't it, if it's forgiven, it's wiped away? And so she tells her boyfriend that she has not been with anyone else. The two get married, and then years go by. It comes out that she has, in fact, been with other men. What happens to the covenant? Is the covenant broken because of prior deceit? I don't know how you would advise in situations like these. These are where having lots of wisdom, understanding God, we all know that the lying part was bad. Would we all agree that lying to get something is wrong? But what happens if you enter into a covenant, something that's more than just some simple agreement, but something that's much stronger, much more binding? What does God want us to do? Does he want us to retain the covenant? Or does he want us to dissolve the covenant because of past deceit? That's what we're going to find out here in chapter 9. We're going to find out that the Israelites are going to meet with a group of people, and they're from this town. They're called the Gibeonites. And we're going to find out that they're going to be tricked into a treaty, and how they deceive the Israelite nation is quite ingenious, to be honest. And then the Israelites are going to enter into a covenant with them. And the question is, what happens to the covenant? Let's find out. So now when all the kings, so we've just had this incredible victory again at Ai. They've had victory at Jericho. They had the setback at Ai, but then they followed after God. They did his strategies. They did that. And then they renewed the covenant with God with the two mountains, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And they're now looking to continue on into the promised land. So now when all the kings west of the Jordan heard about these things. Those in the hill country, in the western foothills along the entire coast of the Great Sea as far as Lebanon, the kings of the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, they came together to make war against Joshua and Israel. So the people in the land are realizing, look, the Israelites are coming in and they're picking off the towns one by one. So they said, here's an idea. Instead of waiting for them to come attack a town and take it over and keep doing that, why don't we gather all of our towns, all of our forces, we'll come together in this large-scale attack and we will go after them. So that's kind of the setting that's happening here. So they came together to make war against Joshua and Israel. Verse 3, however, when the people of Gideon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. It's interesting that the word ruse is used several times in the Old Testament, both in positive ways and in negative ways. If it was negative, we might say that they participated in something that was wily and deceptive. If it was in a positive way, it was almost like, hey, we found a loophole, or we found a way that we can get around this. And it was viewed upon as something that was almost wise in nature. So if you're a reader of the Old Testament, at this point you're like, well, I don't know what is this? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? So they resorted to this ruse. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins, cracked and mended. The men put on patched sandals on their feet and wore old clothes. All the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. Then they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant land. Make a treaty with us." So they had heard through the grapevine, as they hit places like Jericho and Ai, that there's no survivors. When they get to these towns, they wipe it out completely. Everyone dies, and then in the case of Jericho, all of the spoils are burned up or the gold and silver is put into the treasury, but once they hit Ai, now the people can participate in the plunder. They can enjoy some of the fruits of their conquests. So what happens is in Gibeon, they're like, I see the handwriting on the wall. We've got all these armies that are amassing behind us and they're about to make war. We've got Israel in front of us. And now what do we do? It's almost a case of those, if you can't beat them, join them things. In grade school, I became best friends with a guy named Jason. Jason was the school bully. Jason was not necessarily strong. Jason wasn't necessarily tough. Jason was just a little bit crazy. So when he would get into fights, often with kids many times his size, it really didn't matter because Jason was going to win because Jason was crazy. And I was thinking to myself, do I want to be beaten up by Jason? Well, no, so what do you do with Jason? Well, just become his friend, and then you become his friend. If I can't beat him, I'm going to join him. Now, I didn't join in on like bullying or beating up, but I just didn't want it. And this is kind of the feeling that's happening here. The Israelites are saying, or the Gibeonites are saying, the Israelites are wiping everyone off the map. We've heard rumor that their God has told them that when they get to places, wipe them out. So we need to come up with a plan that tricks them to thinking that we are not from around here. If they find out that we're from around here, they're just going to kill us on the spot. So why don't we come up with a plan? We're going to get our old out, worn out sneakers. We're going to grab our robes that are a little bit more musty and torn. We're going to grab some food that people have left in their refrigerators a little bit too long, and now it's gross and moldy. And they said, let's grab this, and we're going to go to the Israelites, and we're going to say, hey, guys, we heard, like, you guys are tough, and we want to make a treaty with you saying we'll join your ranks and your forces. And they planned it in advance. If they ask us where we're from, we'll just tell them we came from a long way. And then we'll produce the evidence, the worn out clothes, the moldy bread, everything. They look tired and haggard. We will act as if we're from far away, but really we're just the next town over. So that's the ruse that they have going on here. So verse 7, the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "But perhaps you live near us. How then can we make a treaty with you?" So already there's some suspicion. I don't know if we can make a treaty with you, because we were told everyone's got to go. And if you're from around here, we will break our God's commandment. So I don't know. Like, are you from around here? You know, we can't make a treaty with you if you're from here. And verse 8, "We are your servants," they said to Joshua. So the idea is now, let's talk to the head honcho. So they go to Joshua. "We're your servants," which is, again, their way of saying, we're going to do whatever you want us to do. This almost sense of, well, I don't know, I think it actually was humility in some respects, but probably not the most honest type of humility, right? And they said to Joshua, "We're servants." And Joshua has the same concern. Who are you, and where do you come from? It's a pretty straightforward question, right? Tell us a little bit about yourself. They answered, "Oh, your servants have come from a very distant country." Like, well, where are you from? Like, if I asked Mike, where are you from? Are you guys from Texas? No, or your kids are just, who lived a long way? Who's from Nebraska? There we go. Let's do Nebraska. Oh, we could do also Miriam. She's from England. But let's do Nebraska. So imagine you come up and you talk to Julie, and you say, "Well, I haven't seen you around Searchlight. Well, where are you from?" And she goes, "Oh, long way away." You'd be like, why don't you just say, like, where you're from? Like, "I'm from Nebraska," unless you're really embarrassed from being from Nebraska, which I know you're not at all. So it's kind of this weird thing of, where are you from? "Oh, from far away. We've heard of the fame of the Lord your God, for we've heard reports of him, all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who reign in Ashtaroth." This is, again, very wily. If they would have said, "We heard what you did to Jericho and Ai," the next question you would have is, how'd you hear about this so quickly? Like, this just happened. But the Sihon, king of Og, and the other dude, I can't remember his name, that happened years and years and years ago. So they're really smart. Like, we've heard that this is happening. They almost seem to have all the right answers. And so they say, verse 11, "And our elders and all those living in our country said to us, 'Take provisions for your journey. Go and meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Make a treaty with us.' And they say, 'This bread of ours was warm when we packed it at home on the day we left to come to you. But now see how dry and moldy it is. And these wineskins that we filled were new, but see how cracked they are. And our clothes and our sandals are worn out by the very long journey.'" This is good, isn't it? Oh, that's a good ruse. And it's really tough, because how do you verify something like this? I remember vividly when I was on my vicarage, I was being trained how to be a pastor, and one of the things that ends up being part of the pastoral duties is dealing with people who are outside of the church, sometimes who are homeless, and, you know, what is a good way to help out and you know, do stuff. And I know that some of it is, you got to make sure that, you know, what they're saying is relatively true. So I remember when I was sitting in my office, and this guy had come into the pastor's office right across the hallway, and so he buzzed me, says, "Vicar, come in here." And I was like, "Okay, sure." So I came in, and he says, "Meet," and I can't remember the guy's name, so we're going to just call him Joe. "Meet Joe here. he's telling us a little bit about stuff that's going on in his life and that he needs some help. And so I sat and I listened to him. Now, Joe is a very interesting guy, very well spoken. And he talked about how he's trying to get back home. And so he's trying to get some bus fare because he needs to get all the way up something like to Minnesota. And he says, but you can call like some people that I know and you can verify that my story is true. And I'm sorry, it was really hard listening to him because he had a weird, something medically, he had a small slit in his throat, which was really weird. And I couldn't tell if it was like, is that something that you've had for a long time? Is it just new and it's kind of healed? Is it something he's had as a kid? But, you know, I'd just be staring at this. And then he had two little pins, two little flags on his lapel. And I was like, this is interesting. Anyway, listening to the story as he's talking. And so he said, well, let's call. So he would call. He called a couple of these numbers and he's talking to them. And they're like, oh, yeah, we know Joe. Yeah, he's a good guy. Yeah, if he needs help, if you can get him up here, we could take care of him when he gets here. But yeah, he needs some help. And we're going on and on, and it appeared, all the evidence was there, right? You know, we got the moldy bread, the worn out shoes, just like the Israelites. His story seems to check out, so we as a church said, let's help this guy out. And we gave him some money that was able to do. We thought that was going to be the end of it. Well, it was very interesting because about 2 weeks later, I get a buzz on the telecom. A vicar, come here. So I walk into the pastor's office, and he hands me a newspaper. And he says, take a look at this newspaper. This is from today's paper. And I go, okay, what is it? And I look at it, and I go, okay, so I know the new bus line around Mesa and Gilbert, Arizona had just finally come online, and so they were excited, and you know, on the page was the first writer of the thing, and I'm like, who cares? So it's a new bus system. He goes, well, take a closer look at the guy, and I looked, and it's like, hey, that guy's wearing like the two pins on the flag, and wait. Hold on a second. Is that a hole in the guy's neck? It was the same guy. He lied. It was a great ruse. Kind of like what happened here. This is a pretty good ruse, don't you think? They've got all the evidence. You know, seeing is believing. Everything seems to be appropriate there. So what do you do? Verse 14, even Israel, they said, you know, let's not just look at it. You know, let's make sure that. So they actually sample some of the provisions. They drink a little bit of the wine. Oh, man. And Bob, just try this. Try this bread. Harold, oh, yeah, this is really, really gross. Yet they didn't do one thing which they seem to still have a problem with, which is their indictment now, which is, they did not inquire of the Lord. And I get it. I mean, we end up having to make decisions a lot throughout the day. Are we going to inquire on everything? Lord, should we go to In-N-Out or Del Taco this afternoon? Well, is there any? Yeah, it's just In-N-Out. That's a better thing, yeah. Lord, I'm about to buy a car. Should I get this one car, Honda, or should I buy a Lamborghini? Okay, that one's dumb too. But you see what I mean? We've got stuff going on all day long. We don't inquire of God with everything, which I think is actually one of our problems. They don't inquire of God. So, verse 15, so then Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live. And the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. So this is not just a quick little handshake. And again, when they would do these oaths, these covenants, it was often, there was blood involved. Usually what you would do is, if I'm going to enter into a covenant with you, we would get an animal and we would cut it in half, and then we would spread it apart, and we'd let the blood kind of come to the middle, and then we would walk across that. And the idea behind that was, if we break this oath, then what happened to the animal happens to us. That's, would you say that's a pretty strong covenant? I'd say that's pretty harsh. And so they made the covenant, the treaty with them, and ratified by an oath. 3 days later, they made the treaty with the Gibeonites. The Israelites heard that they were neighbors living near them. So they were like, you know, after the oath is done, they're like, hey, this is great. Thank you. We're going to travel the long journey back to Gibeon, to our hometown. And somehow or other, the Israelites find out that they're not that far away. Verse 17, so the Israelites set out, and on the third day came to their cities, Gibeon, Caraphah, Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim. But the Israelites did not attack them because the leaders of the assembly had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. So they go, travel, they find out, yep, there's that dude. The one wearing the flags, a little hole in his neck, I see you. Yeah, no, you stayed in my tent. And they find out that it was all a lie. So now question, do you see the quandary? We now have conflicting oaths. We have God who has given you a command. You will take out all these people, but then you make an oath not to kill those people. Which one wins? This is a little bit tougher, isn't it? God gives you a command. Don't marry someone who is a non-Christian. But what happens if you end up marrying someone who you think is a Christian, but then you find out later that they weren't? Which, what do you do? What if you, real example, let's say you are in exile for not following God's commands, and so you're coming back into the land that God has promised you, and the people are like, you know what? We didn't follow God's commands. And one of God's commands was we were not supposed to marry foreign wives. And we kind of married some foreign wives. And so I think we need to divorce them all. What would you say to someone who had lied about their relations from the past? And now you entered into a covenant with them. Do you see the conflict that's here? What do you do? And right now, the Israelites are saying, well, we're not going to attack you because we made this oath. And what does God think? Does God like this oath? Does God want the Israelite nation to honor the oath not to destroy them? Or does he want them to follow his command to destroy them? Not an easy answer, is it? Does anyone know what actually ends up happening? It's crazy. And it gets even better. So the whole assembly grumbled against the leaders. Yeah, don't you hate it when leaders enter into covenants on your behalf and you find out that it was bad for you to enter into that covenant? Yeah, does that ever happen? Yeah, it doesn't matter which party you're affiliated with. Everyone's upset with whatever leader did this certain thing. We despise that thing. What about in churches? You know, in churches we have leadership that kind of runs things while everyone else says, well, we elect the leaders and hopefully they're doing stuff that's smart and good. But what happens when they don't? Can the Israelites, the regular folk, can they say, hey, look, you... leaders entered into this covenant, but we didn't, so maybe we can break it. So they're grumbling, but the leaders answered, we have given them our oath by the Lord, the God of Israel, and we cannot touch them now. This is what we will do to them. We will let them live so that the wrath will not fall on us for breaking the oath we swore to them. They continued, let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for the entire community. So the leader's promise to them was kept. So one crisis averted, everyone was like, this is really bad, but there was a punishment, there was a price to be paid for the deception. You will not live among us in a certain way. You will always be kind of an indentured servant. You'll always be in this relationship with us. But then it gets even more interesting because Joshua gets here. And he says, Joshua summoned the Gibeonites and said, why did you deceive us by saying we live a long way from here? Well, actually, you live near us. You are now under a curse. You will never cease to serve as woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God. So it's also interesting that, yeah, you're going to do this, but you're also going to do this for the temple. And this is a strange move by Joshua, that he was essentially keeping these people closer to God than anyone else. They were going to be woodcutters and water carriers and serving at the temple. Kind of an interesting thing. And they answered Joshua, your servants were clearly told how the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you the whole land and to wipe out all its inhabitants from before you. So we feared for our lives because of you, and that is why we did this. We are now in your hands. Do to us whatever seems good and right to do. So they come clean and they say, this is, yeah, you're right. It's a little bit like what happened with Rahab, right? Rahab hears of the power of God and then says, I'm with you and I will help you out, but didn't do it with deception. But they're kind of doing the same thing. So they are told that they can live. And listen to how this ends. Joshua saved them from the Israelites, so they did not kill them. That day he made the Gibeonites woodcutters and water carriers for the community, for the altar of the Lord and the place the Lord would choose, and that is what they are to this day. And what's really interesting is, we have to stop the story here, but you know what's happening now? Have you guys forgotten there was an army amassing behind them? What would happen if the army decides to attack and flow right through Gibeon? You've got a loophole, right? You were told you couldn't kill them, but if someone else wipes them out, I don't know, what do you think about that? Would that be a good ruse? Would that be a good way to get out of a covenant? We're big about getting out of covenants. We have a little bit of an idea of how much God honors covenants. A little while later, in 1 Samuel 21, there's a guy named Saul who's a little bit crazy, and he decides that he doesn't like the Gibeonites. He doesn't like that years passed, they became a part of the people of God through deception, and so you know what? I think I'm going to kill them all. And so he went on this rampage and started slaughtering the Gibeonites. And all of a sudden, there was a 3-year famine. And so they come to God and say, God, what's up with this 3-year famine? And God says, you broke your covenant. Isn't that interesting? The very thing that God had asked them to do in the first place, they didn't do because of the covenant, but they kept the covenant, keeping them safe. But then later on, a person comes along and does what was supposed to be originally done, and then God punishes them because he says, you broke your covenant. Do you see how this works? It's also interesting, a guy by the name of David, he had what we call his mighty men, David's mighty men. It's very interesting. One of his mighty men is a Gibeonite. I think that for us, we have problems with deception, and rightfully so. But I think we always are trying to find ways to get out of covenants. And I would caution against that, because there's another point to this. This whole sermon I've been talking about us being the Israelites and keeping a covenant with someone who is a deceiver. But let's be honest, are we more like the Israelites? Or are we more like the Gibeonites? When you came to faith or you've lived your Christian life, have you ever made promises that maybe you didn't keep? Maybe you stood before a congregation after completing a two-year instruction program, and you vowed that you would be in church regularly, that you would read your Bible, that you would live a godly and Christian life, right? And then you don't. Does God abandon the covenant with you because you lied? You later on get caught in some sin and it's really, really, really bad, and you say to God, God, I will never do that again. I promise with everything I have, I will not do that. And then what happens a year, 2 years, 5 years down the road? All of a sudden, that comes back, and does God say to you, well, you lied, so the covenant is over? Do you see, that's the reason why God is a covenant maker and God is a covenant keeper. God keeps his covenant even when we are liars, even when we are deceivers, even when we do the things wrong. And he tells us that's how we live, that there are going to be times that we're going to be deceived and we're going to be lied to. And the easiest thing to do is to somehow break covenant. But we always got to know that God doesn't do that with us. He doesn't do it with you, and he doesn't do it with me. So, are you in a covenant with someone and they've lied to you? Maybe we need to pray about that. Maybe we need to seek the Lord about that, because I think the answer is not as easy as we sometimes make it out to be. But probably more importantly, shouldn't we take some time and come back to God and say, God, I have broken faith with you. I have not done what you have asked. Please forgive me. And some of you are like, I've already asked him for this stuff, and he's already forgiven me, and I've already lied again, and I did what I know I wasn't supposed to do. And God says, I'm not going to break my covenant with you. I will not leave you. I will not forsake you. You are my children. Let's pray. Father, a difficult passage to understand, a difficult passage because we don't do covenants very well. If someone lies to us, we are really quick to make sure it's pointed out, and we're quick to make sure that there's nothing that's there anymore. But you are so into covenants, so much so that we are not to be breaking covenants. We're also supposed to be constantly reminded of how you have done so much for us in keeping the covenant, even when we have been faithless and we've been deceptive. And it's so weird, Lord, because I know a lot of us being deceptive, we think we're fooling the people around us, but you see right through it. You already know it. Lord, I know that this is not about the Gibeonite deception, but it's really more about the honoring of promises. And I pray that you would help us see how important these covenants are in the relationships that we have, in the people that we know. But also, most importantly, thank you for the covenant you made with us. And it was sealed not by cutting an innocent animal in half, but it came about because of the death of your Son, Jesus Christ, whose blood was spilled to pay for the covenant we broke. And now we're in this new covenant with Jesus, as he has promised with his own blood for our forgiveness. So help us, Lord, to be people who keep covenants, who honor those covenants. And may we also come back to you asking for forgiveness for the times we've broken the covenant with you. And thank you that we get a chance to celebrate that through communion and understanding the death of Jesus Christ and receiving your Holy Spirit and your presence with us. Thank you in the name of Jesus, our Savior.